Hey everyone, welcome to the Latent Space Podcast. This is Alessio, partner and CTO at Decibel, and I'm joined by my co-host Swix, founder of Small AI.
Hey, and this is a little bit of a Latent Space Discord reunion because we have Vacek in the house from B2B. Welcome.
Hey, good to see you guys. Thank you for having me.
Help me with your last name because I realize I've never had to pronounce it. Mlejski.
I guess close in. But Mlejski.
Mlejski.
Yeah, and okay. My like official legal first name is Václav. But everyone pronounces it as Vaclav, which I hate. So it's just Vasek.
Okay, awesome. We're both invested in E2B in different ways. But you and I go back the furthest. I just realized 3 years ago when you were working on DevBook and you were interested in like sort of that developer experience angle and somehow you pivoted to E2B. Yeah. Maybe you want to tell that story.
Yeah, so Thomas, my co-founder, who's our CTO, we've been interested in DevTools for quite a long time, like 6-8 years. And before DevBook, there was like a bunch of iterations. After that, there were like different iterations and pivots of DevBook. We just like stopped renaming things at some point and just like went with DevBook. The one you are talking about was interactive documentation for developers. So basically the idea was we wanted to, instead like you as a developer, when you come to a tools docs website, instead of reading about everything and then Googling it and trying it in your coding editor, the idea was to give you interactive experience in the browser. So you would have like pre-made interactive guides, playgrounds, you could try things right away. And the company, the owner of the docs, would prepare the experience for you because you would also be trying everything in the browser. They would now see if you get stuck anywhere, what you are doing, you know, so you get a very valuable onboarding like analytics. We actually built an interactive playground for Prisma. I think it's still up. They are still using it. The last time I checked a couple months ago. So it was like interactive guides and playground that you could try out Prisma without, you know, having to manually set up all the databases and everything. So you could just try Prisma right away. And that was like the very, very first version of actually our infrastructure that we are offering now.
Basically sandboxes.
It was sandboxes. It literally was sandboxes, the same technology, but just completely unscalable.
So then that somehow in 2024-ish turned to E2B?
2023.
Okay.
We were pretty burnt out. Thomas and I, we were working from Prague, from the Czech Republic, from my apartment. Nothing was really moving. No growth, and GPT 3.5 came out. Like really first model, kind of good-ish with CodeGen. So we took a let's take 10 days break, 2 weeks break from DevBook. And because like everyone was trying things with AI, it was very clear like this is something where the future might go. So we wanted to just like from out of curiosity, try things out. We wanted to build like a AI, like DevIn, kind of like thing. The first idea we had was like, let's automate our work because with every project we were starting, there was a set of tools you always want to integrate in your backend, like Stripe, like for SaaS business, like Stripe analytics, Slack notifications, emails, sending out emails. And so we gave the agent tools to run code and we needed some kind of sandbox. We were like, yeah, that's good coincidence. Right. We have sandbox from DevBook. And we posted about it on Twitter. Basically, the agent actually pulled GitHub repository, wrote code, started the server, tested everything. And at that point, I think we deployed it to Railway. Railway had like the best DX and it was easiest to just plug it in into the agent. I tweeted about it and I think Greg Brockman like retweeted it. Like, hey, like I don't remember exactly what he said. I need to find a tweet, but it was around the time where OpenAI was retweeting or OpenAI co-founders were retweeting all the things that people are doing, like to show like what you can do with GPT 3.5. And people, like it had like 500,000 views after a few days. And so with Thomas, we were like, we got to do something. Like people are interested in it. Like, so we just open sourced it, the repository. And it was named, the organization was like the AI company. Like we had no name. Mm-hmm. I kind of wish like we could have legally stick with that. We just came up with a name. We was like E2B because you take English, you convert it to bits. that's how it started. We started building community around it. And like 2 days later, we were like, let's focus on the sandbox part, not on the agent part. And we actually had a bunch of hypotheses behind it, like why it might be more interesting than building the agent.
Yeah. And then you had the small developer on E2B, which...
That was a little bit later.
Yeah, what was the... What? So
this is in 2023
when
as well.
You first launched E2B, it was kind of like a AI agents cloud. What did you call it?
23, the hypothesis was like agents, code gen agents especially, will need some kind of environment to run the code. And the same way a developer needs a laptop or something, you know? So, but we struggle a lot with how the product should actually look like and what's like a go-to-market, the first version. And so the high-level idea was like, we will host your agent, everything from actually deploying it to then monitoring it, and it will also have this environment running the code. One of the first like test project was taking Sean's small agent project and deploying it inside our sandbox and just giving the agent tools to pull the GitHub repositories, work on that, do a PR, and then post it on GitHub. Post the PR on GitHub, which was very, very popular. Like there was clear, was clear that like there was something very
interesting.
It's
amazing how much people went with that. It was literally not meant to do that. It was meant to do Chrome extensions.
Yeah, and I think like you really, you had good insight that you let the agent plan the work in a markdown file, basically, and just, like write down the spec. Which I think even now, when you look at deep research agents, like that's sort of oftentimes what they are doing. Like they plan everything.
Yeah, these days I would say they should do more structured output than Markdown, but you know that's an implementation detail.
Yeah. So that was taking off, but it attracted a little bit different audience than we wanted. Because it attracted a lot of people who nowadays would be using tools like Lovable, for example. You know, they just wanted to build projects for them. And of course, like, it wasn't really working at the time. it worked for like a simple website, but the moment you wanted something more complex, like, it was really hard.
I've been also reflecting on why I stopped working on it. And there was actually so when I built it, it was with Claude 3. Yeah. The new Claude 3 launch. I was trying to utilize the 100K context of Claude 3. And I used the same project to do this, to try to repeat the demo that I made for myself a month afterwards. And it wasn't anywhere as smart. So Claude 3 got dumber. But it looks like I like made up the demo or something. But no, like literally I just reran the same code and it just was not as capable.
Yeah.
And I think to some extent this is like RNGesus, you know, hurting me, or like it's the time that it's like a different month, so like the model is like different or something. But I think also like basically people had this vision of what they wanted and then they tried to do it in reality and they couldn't do it because the models are not ready.
So a lot of feedback we got at some point people thought like small agents is from us, because like we had a website like deploy small agent, but we were no, like that's like Sean's work. you should go to his repository, submit an issue.
No, they could clone it. It was like, you know, a few hundred lines of code.
Cloned, yeah, whatever. I did it however you want. For us, it was more like a test if the environment, the sandbox is useful for the agent, if it can sort of scale and it can work, which worked well. But then it took us another, I would say, 6 months to actually find the right, you know, go-to-market strategy, which was code interpreting for us. So typically AI data analysis, data visualization inside like a headless Jupyter type of notebook and environment.
Specifically Jupyter?
It doesn't need to be Jupyter. The important part is that you don't need to explain the model and the model doesn't need to care about how to keep the state of the program running. So it was especially with our earlier models, I think the models are now smarter, but they kept producing like code snippets and thought like they can reference to previous you know, variables and functions definitions, which if you had only normal code execution, like you run the code snippet and then you finish, it wouldn't work. Like, so you need some kind of REPL environment. And what was, I think, especially early on, like Python was the language that the models were probably the best, or one of the first languages where the models were working really well. Looking back at it, there was like a really strong pull from people just wanting to visualize data and talk with their data. Python was really good at it, and it mixes well with Jupyter type of environment because you get charts out of the box. You can also support interactive charts. Jupyter itself isn't the right environment to actually do it because all the technical problems that you will run into once you start doing it on scale. So it gets slower and slower. And actually, like, what we are coming into is like we are building our own thing internally, just like to support LLM specifically. It's called like your own runtime.
At what point did you start going from just code interpreter, run code to like expand? Because now you have, you know, people doing RFT, you have computer use and all of those things. Like, when were the models ready for people to start using it? Just, you know, you demoed at one of our first events as well. And I think there's always this lag between the infrastructure that you build and like the capabilities of the model. When did you go from just code interpreter to start saying, okay, now it's time to do computer use, now it's time to do RFT?
That was probably end of 24, start of 25. So when you look even at our data, like 24, we are growing good, but 25 is like up to the right. And so it feels like at 24, people are like figuring out these agents and building them and trying them. And 25 is everyone moving them into production and finding more and more use cases. Around end of 24, start of 25, we started seeing things like using Sandbox for reinforcement learning type of use cases, or using Sandbox as a for computer use, which was very interesting when Anthropic launched their computer use. We had like a desktop version of a Sandbox that was sitting like in our GitHub repository for 6 months. We were like, okay, this is probably interesting, but no model can actually use it. So when Anthropic announced it, it was like, oh, like we have something here we can show you. Using with like Lovables and Blitz's type of products also like started using the Sandbox for more than just like run code snippet, like data analysis. And then deep research agents, that has been something really big in the last few months.
How does deep research agents, are you referring to Manus or?
Yeah, Manus, for example, one of the companies.
Deep research, I typically think of as like a search, like a web search heavy task. Doesn't really use a code interpreter in any way. I have some idea that Manus uses E2B in an interesting code interpret-y way to do deep research. What's the difference?
Yeah, I think it's a good idea to stop thinking about the Sandbox just for code interpreting and more about like a runtime, code runtime for the LLM or the agent. The use case for the Sandbox, it's a very horizontal in a sense that it can cover everything from the agent needs to create a file, make a to-do list. It uses a browser, not inside the Sandbox. That's like separate. You have browser use, being used for research on the website, but then you download the data somewhere, you need to transform the data, you want to do data analysis, you want to actually write a small app, you want to create a Excel sheet. So it's the same way you are using, you know, your laptop as a human, that is the same useful for the agent. So you can think about it as more like a dev box. And at the same time, the agent that's using it is also like a very, very good developer, good accountant, good like slides creator, researcher. And so you are just basically giving it tools to let it do the job even better and faster.
Yeah.
And when you say up and to the right, I just want to share some numbers from the investor updates. So March 24, which
this is
we're talking
to share,
about.
I don't know.
Yeah. You shared these publicly.
Yeah.
In March 24, you were doing 40,000 sandboxes. You want to say how many you've done last month, March 2025?
15 million.
Yeah.
Around that.
So
yeah.
In 1 year, you've gone from 40,000 to 15 million. And yeah, I think you can kind of see the slope, especially from like the Sonnet 3.7 release. And I think this is like an interesting model versus infrastructure. I think there's this usual like VCEO, we should invest in like the tools, the picks and shovels instead of the application layer. But I think this is like the first time where like the infrastructure is lagging the applications.
Yeah,
that's
a good point. Like I think 24 was all about like the agent couldn't use the whole sandbox. And now, sometimes we are actually like catching up on with some features for the LMs that they need more than what we have at the moment.
Yeah, I guess like what we're doing here, you know, you are another one of the LLMOS companies that we are talking to. We also did one with BrowserBase, and I'm not sure who else would qualify under that term.
Exa,
yeah. Yeah, so like basically like you don't specifically yourself use LLMs internally in your product, but you enable others to work to augment their LLMs with your infrastructure.
Yeah.
I don't know, any reflections on just the general LLMOS landscape? You have other competitors, like, you know, how is this evolving? How do you position in it?
A lot of people are saying, like, if you are a GPT wrapper in 23, you were really bad positioned because, like, all the value will be captured by the AI labs. It's a good to be a GPT wrapper because you get all the advantages from a new model. You just switch it. I mean, the just is, like, not so simple. You probably have evals. Need to change the prompt a little bit. But I would say it's increasingly easier to switch models. So we need to think about it the same way. Like our users are switching models a lot. We need to be agnostic to the LLMs. Oftentimes, like people want to deploy us in their cloud or on premise. So that's also something very important. I think a good analogy here is sort of like technologically, it's kind of you want to be the Kubernetes of the world for the agent, but with much better DX and easier to use.
One thing I'm thinking about also is like, what is valuable real estate to occupy in the LLMOS? And I have this spectrum, I think on the BrowserBase episode I was talking about, like either you can focus on browser emulation or you can focus on the VM or you can do like a custom Python sandbox like Modal does.
Yeah.
You know, like, would you say that you're the most general of all of them?
Yes, it's very general, but that's not really historically how you want to market it because people don't know what to do with it.
Okay.
So that like we started as when we had our website in 24, it said something like computer, like cloud computer for AI. People didn't just understand like what to do with it. So we had to like literally show them like first you change it to code interpreting because that's something people knew from OpenAI. And then you just show them very, very specific use case. And you use that to get an early traction and an early set of users. And we spend a lot of time, I mean, Teresa from our team spent a lot of time, especially her, on educating the market, yes. You know, and developers. So, and I think this is the space, the AI space is, you sometimes have to like show developers what they might need. And you kind of have to like trust your gut, like this might go in this direction, maybe like this could make sense. And show them like what they can build with it because it's very hard to imagine what you can build with things that you don't even have, right? So like, why would you need forking sandboxes or checkpointing sandboxes? Like, how is that useful? Well, it turns out if you're building some Monte Carlo type of a thing, search for our agent, like it's very useful. But like to actually go for a developer who might not be like in the AI deep research type of thing, like it's not obvious. So you want to be agnostic, you want to be general, but you want to also show people like very clear use cases, how they can use you. And over the time, they then get educated and realize, okay, like there's more use cases, understand the platform. They start coming up with their own ideas, but onboard people with general use cases is very hard for, that's what we learned hard way.
Yeah. And you also don't really tailor to like the more DevOps infrastructure person, which I think a lot of the other sandboxes are like, oh, we have a gVisor runtime and we have all these like different terms that you don't really know if you're like the AI engineer type.
Yeah, that's exactly true that our user isn't like an infra engineer. Even ML engineer usually isn't our type of a user. It's like AI engineer, you know, like the from the definition you have. I still remain very bullish web developers and JavaScript world, TypeScript world, even though we have like a ton of usage from Python. But there's so many web developers and it's easier and easier to use LLMs. I really think that you need to cater to these type of developers and make it like things simple for them. And if they want to dive in, they can, chances are like they don't even want to. They want to focus on building.
Yeah, product developers, infrastructure developers. It's very interesting. Yeah, I mean, like, this whole GPT wrapper versus Model Lab thing, it's not like, you know, it's better to work on wrapper over Model Labs because, you know, the Model Labs people are making a lot of money. It's just that there is room for wrappers and the wrappers also do make money. And I think people were not seeing that in 2023.
Yeah.
And this is what we saw.
It's not, you know, binary.
It's not either or. Yeah. Yeah, I think, and then just a quick check. Do you know like the rough percentage between JavaScript and Python?
A slightly less JavaScript.
More Python still.
So from number of downloads of our SDK per month, it's like 250,000 JavaScript, close to around 500,000 Python.
Yeah.
Something around that.
2 to 1.
Yeah,
interesting. I mean, if the use case is really for code interpreting, generating charts and all these, then Python wins.
Python wins for that. But once you go into more like, for example, building apps, AI-generated apps, then it's JavaScript winning, right? Because you probably have frameworks, all the Svelte, Next.js, Vue.js frameworks, which is like JavaScript thing. It's interesting because I would think that it doesn't really matter what code you want the LLM to produce. Like, it wouldn't dictate what kind of user is using us, right? But if you think about it, when developers are building like AI data analysis, it's typically Python developer. When developers building like a type of V0 like a use case, level like a use case, it's web developer, it's a product developer. So I don't think this is like super obvious that I wouldn't think that would be the case.
There's all sorts. I mean, Bolt's argument is that you should want to use something like a web container where it's like run on your own browser and it's all you know, free and very fast. I guess one more critical question, like, let's say I do know my infra. Well, what is the point of a cloud for AI, like computer for AI? Like, so basically, why can't I use existing tools like Railway? Which I'm sure Railway wants to go after your customers, right? So like, why does there need to be an AI focused, you know, virtual machine or sandbox or execution environment, whatever you call it?
What we offer is sort of orthogonal to cloud. So beforehand, you don't know what kind of code you will be running in our cloud. So you can't really optimize it, right? So there's no like a build deploy step per se. Everything happens ad hoc during runtime. So you need to solve problems like you want to install dependencies very fast. You want to be able to pull GitHub repositories very, very fast. So then how do the workloads we are running can go from 5 seconds to 5 hours. So that also like changes even the pricing model a lot. How do you make sure that everything makes sense for you and for the user, like from the pricing point of view, from the like unit economics, and also from the, like just the infrastructure point of view, where the you know, the sandboxes are getting placed inside your cluster. The security model is also different usually, because also comes down to you don't know beforehand what code you will run. So by default, it's untrusted code. And you need to have complete isolation between these sandboxes to make sure first that like if something happens in one sandbox, it doesn't affect other sandboxes. But also you want to know about security inside the sandbox. So as the LLMs are getting better, you want to know what's happening inside the sandbox. There's like a fun story from Hugging Face when they were using us and are using us for their open R1 model. And one of the developers, he shared it online, so I think it's okay to say that. So he lost access to their cluster because the LM decided to change permissions. If that happens with us, we just like kill the sandbox and get a new one. And it takes like, I don't know, 150 milliseconds. For them, like they had to take down the whole cluster, set up everything. Didn't even know that this happened. So it's like the model, the compute model, TLDR is the compute model, security model is different from like current cloud providers. And you need to think from the first days about it differently.
And then people use, depending on because the difference that maybe people don't think about is like, you can generate the code with the Python SDK, but it can still run Lua code or like R code. It's not always matched to the runtime of SDK.
Yeah, you can, it's a general machine. So whatever you can run on a Linux, you can run inside a sandbox. And we had users like running, of course, like Python code, but C++, We had Fortran, someone running Fortran, which is like...
Why?
They were doing some like using very old API for like banking or something like that. But you can also start a server inside a sandbox, and then you want it to be accessible from the internet. It's a very general machine. And the challenge is like, how do you make everything fast, for example? How do you make everything secure? At the same time, you need to make it accessible enough and controllable by the LLM and observable for a human. So you're kind of building for two personas, for the human developer, the AI engineer, and for the LLM who's like using the sandbox.
Yeah, the composability thing is something I had not thought about before. But later, like you mentioned, it's like, you know, you might need to run Fortran to access one API. And then in the next step, you'll need to take that data and run it in a Python script. Yeah. And then you're going to expose that through JavaScript to something else. And like, you guys can switch the runtime.
Yeah.
Halfway.
Yeah. And in ideal world, you don't want to kill the sandbox, start a new one, or maybe like create a new sandbox template. You just want to keep using the computer. And because we are in cloud, we can do it in a way that you can get more RAM, you can get more CPU, you can get less CPU. So you are really paying only for what you need. And as the LLM is doing more and more, you can have very elastic sandbox and keep adding features. And the goal where we think this is going is the LLM like decides what it wants to do and how it wants to have the sandbox configured. So it basically starts controlling the infrastructure itself and creating sandboxes themselves.
While we're talking about the technical details, I just wanted to let you tell people about any other technical details. Like, what is the box that we get? What kind of Linux? What size of whatever? What details matter here?
So you get Ubuntu box. You can customize it and anything Debian-based is going to work. You can even add, you know, graphical interface. So if you want to, you can run like legit, not headless, but like legit Ubuntu computer on it.
So like, you can do the sort of take out, like an operator type experience, like you take over control.
Yeah, and we have an SDK called Desktop SDK that does this for you out of the box.
Yep.
And it supports VNC. So you can also have like a human in the loop type of a thing and control everything and stream and see what's happening. So by default, you get two CPUs and half a gig of RAM on the free tier. And you can customize it. On our landing page, we say up to 8 gigs. But if you tell us what's your use case, you can go to 64 gigs of RAM. We have users using such a beefy sandboxes. You can go to 16 CPUs, I think, if I'm not mistaken. And
storage is free.
Storage is free. I think there's like a lot of things that are free that we probably need to think about a little bit more. I think, you know, with the dev tools, especially infra, I always see this pattern. And I had this like naive idea as well, that the founder says like, oh, this AWS pricing, it's terrible. Like you are GCP, like you have no idea what you are paying for. There's so many like small add-ons you need to pay for. We will start a new infrastructure company. You're just going to pay $200 per month. And then you just pay for like pure compute. That works until you start scaling and you figure out, okay, like actually like people are doing like weird stuff that I didn't expect, like having lots of traffic producing. We have a customer that produced petabyte of data. I mean, it's not free to host petabyte of data, and that's growing. So then you start introducing, okay, probably they should pay some amount for ingress, egress, for storage. And the pricing gets increasingly complex. So I just think it's a very interesting like phenomenon that you start with this brave idea that everything will be super simple. But
And we only do code interpreting, so we only need to price for compute, right?
Yeah, exactly. And then you like wake up in the real world and it's messy.
So I know about this from like my career in cloud. And so like the common refrain is that I call this the first principle of technology. Everything can be broken down into some combo of compute, storage, and networking. If you fail to price one of them, you will get abused. Because
because you're essentially offering free storage or compute or something, right?
Yeah. For those interested in this idea, there's a fourth one, which is basically the control plane or like the off layer, the IAM policies and all that. And that's like, maybe you can call that security as well. It's like the fourth layer that people kind of pay for as its own independent thing. For those also interested, HashiCorp has more breakdowns from this, like David McJanet, which I think is very interesting. If you're just in the business of running a cloud infrastructure company, you should know these things. Many hundreds of businesses have run into the exact same problems. You should just not repeat them and just learn whatever the best practice is.
Yeah, I think like the billing model has been figured out many times. So yeah. Like, I don't think it's like the challenge is not figuring it out. The challenge is, I think, is introducing it like sometimes quick enough. You actually need to do changes on your infrastructure to make sure you know about all this data that's happening and moving one way or another. But yeah, I completely agree with you. Like this problem, we are not the first one that are having it.
Yeah.
Do you use one of the usage-based billing providers?
Orb.
We are talking with Orb right now. So we are...
Orb and Meter?
Open Meter is another one, I think. Yeah. Or Meter.
Just yeah, Metronome.
Meter is the other one.
Yeah.
We have been using Stripe, Stripe's usage, which has been a little bit sometimes rougher around the edges. Yeah, this is the thing. Like, we shouldn't spend so much engineering on it. Like, I want to outsource it because that's not our product. Someone else should be like focusing on this full time. And it's actually pretty non-trivial, like to make sure you have everything right and you really don't want to make mistakes here.
Yeah. Is there anything that you're really looking for that would say like, okay, that's really what we want, that maybe Orb or Metronome haven't really adjusted for AI yet?
I don't think this is AI specific problem. This is infrastructure as you know it. For us, some things that didn't work when we look at some of the providers where like the cut they took from the revenue, for example, they take from you. So some of the pricings, I don't know what's the latest, but like I don't remember which one was it, honestly, but I knew that pricing was basically they take a small cut from the revenue each month, which is basically like what Stripe does when you are processing payments. It's just like the value was really high. And then it's a lot about how hard it would be to integrate it. Like how much time we are spending on it. Because we know we don't want to build this in-house. It's more like, is the switch worth it, basically?
I'm curious your updated takes. I know you had the why is it usage-based building a bigger category. I'm curious now with AI, with like token-based pricing, if you have updated thoughts on...
So for people who don't have context, at Netlify, we went from a relatively flat tier-based pricing to usage-based billing because that was... that's basically how all infrastructure companies should eventually go, because you have some whales who use a lot of infrastructure and some who don't use that much, and you shouldn't charge the same for both of them. The fun insight was that you would think that at a IaaS PaaS company that revenue is like the most important problem to work on and directly impacts the company's revenue and valuation and all that. No engineers wanted to do it. And I was like, why? Like we actually looked around for a long time. We tried to hire and then we couldn't hire. So we ended up putting one of our most senior engineers on it. And she took a year to ship the whole billing project that was presumably a board level objective, which was like, hey, let's change from this pricing plan to this pricing plan. How hard can that be? Turns out very hard because you have to instrument everything. Even the things that you're like, I don't know if we'll ever use this.
Yeah, that's exactly what I meant.
That's why storage is free.
Yeah, but the first thing is like you need to know about everything that's happening inside a sample, inside a cluster.
How big are your logs?
Yeah, it's crazy hard. The pricing is like actually not the figuring out the business model, but the integration of it and implementation is actually like a lot of engineering.
Like soft limits, like hard limits. Like, do you cut off people once they bust the limits? Probably not, because they get pissed at you.
Yeah.
And then they also get pissed at you if you don't cut them off, because then you send them a big bill.
Yeah.
So you just, there's no winning.
Yeah, exactly. also, additional problem that people are asking us, like, I want to run the agent for 5 hours. And you can do that. And you might be a very early startup. So, like, our goal isn't to, like, cash you out. Our goal is, like, you can use as much of E2B as you can and just grow. But the longer you run the sandboxes, the larger is going to be your bill. So I think that's like, it doesn't really need to correlate with how much product market fit you have, for example, how much users you have, because with these agents, they can work for a long time, even if you are like pretty early stage company. Yeah. If you have few users. So
sure. I mean, yeah. I think, but there's still a question of soft limit, hard limit.
Yeah.
That kind of stuff. So just to answer your question on like billing, and for those who are interested, we actually had the CTO of Orb send in a talk for a remote track for the New York Summit on like what he thinks pricing for agents looks like. And I think basically you are reselling tokens, right? The base layer is coming from either your open model cloud provider or your closed model lab API, and you resell them. And a lot of them, some people have a lot of markup on them, like certain unnamed AI builders, and some people have negative markup on them. Like they are basically selling you at a discount. You should buy as much as you want because they are using VC monies to subsidize your thing. And I think that seems fine. People often, Simon Wilson often asks for like, bring your own key solution where like, you know, I will have my control over like my relationships and my pricing and my credits with my LLM providers. But I want to use your app. So I'll give you my keys and then you use the keys on behalf of me. That doesn't seem to be as popular as I understand it. I don't know if you've had that request.
It's sort of like in crypto, use your own hardware wallet. Always going to be like less popular than just going with the thing that's...
Yeah. So literally, Alex from OpenRouter is the only person who's implemented this. And it's fine for, you know, individual use cases because there's a lot of free tiers for individuals. But yeah, I mean, I think pricing-wise, people are trying to move that discussion on like, you know, are you positive margin on your tokens, or you negative margin of your tokens? And there's some economic reality there, but they're trying to move that to the agent work, which is what is the value of the human labor you're replacing, which is a whole different thing, right? So like, instead of comparing on cost of goods sold, you're comparing on value delivered, and that is much higher.
Yeah, I feel like if we could get to a good market on like bid ask of like work being done, and then you can kind of arbitrage how many tokens you need. But I think today the agents are so unreliable and unpredictable that like it's hard to price ahead of time, because you could price any software engineering task per task, right? It's like do a new bun, it's like $500, and then I can arbitrage that. But today there's no certainty of that, and I'm curious.
Yeah, you would think like also this is why I was very excited about Replit when they first launched their marketplace credit thing. I'm not, if Replit can't do it, then I don't know if anyone can.
Right. Yeah. The other technical thing we talked about before is forking. You also mentioned it before, and sandbox checkpoints and things like that. Is it something you have today? And then what are people using that for? Like our example was the Claude Plays Pokemon hackathon. Are there more enterprise use cases where you see people request forking and checkpoints?
Yeah, we don't have this publicly now yet, but that's something we are working on to release somewhat soon. We have persistence, which is like the prerequisite to the core.
The amount of volume.
Yeah. And well, amount of volume, but also memory persistence, which is very interesting. So you basically can pause the whole sandbox while even when all the code is, you know, with all the context of the code execution, and resume it later and come back to it, I don't know, like 2 weeks later. And it's still going to be there.
But the continuous session time is limited to 24 hours, right?
No, that's limited in the beta in 30 days.
Okay.
Do you mean, are you asking?
I don't know. Like, I was looking at your pricing pages.
Are you asking about like when the sandbox is running? The sandbox can run up to 24 hours, but when it's paused, it can be paused for like a month. I personally think this is like one of the cases where you kind of need to show the developers why it's useful. And this is something I think is going to be very useful as the agents are getting better and LLMs are getting better, because you will be able to parallelize problem solving essentially. So you will, instead of having like a single agent doing one thing, you might have multiple agents trying different paths. And if you imagine like a tree or a graph, every node is like a snapshotted sandbox, like a checkpoint sandbox. And then from that node, you fork the sandbox and go to the next state. Eventually, you find the right path, right? It's kind of like it's a tree search. So the forking and checkpointing solves the local state problem. It doesn't solve the, you know, remote state, because that's something you can't really control, but it solves a local state for the agent, and can then come back to a state, and you don't need to, you know, replay the whole session or trying to force the LLM to do the same thing again. You just have you have the chat history and you have even all the steps inside the sandbox that went to it.
Do you feel like you want to help with like the forking and then the remerging? Because I think people understand the forking, but then it's like, okay, how do I monitor which of the leaves is successful, and then how do I merge that back in the thing? Do you think that's something that you want to help people do, like kind of spread out, parallelize, and then find the winner? Or is that something people should do on their own?
I think this is a sort of like a framework discussion on top of E2B. So this is some, like, we are looking at it. I think eventually, like, we should go more higher level. And I don't know if, like, framework is the right type of a thing. Mm-hmm. We like to, in the team, think about it as a toolkit. Like, instead of, like, building opinionated framework, how to build agents, we give you sort of like a wrapper around E2B that makes it really easy for the LLMs to, for example, merge these states or navigate this tree. So I think it will eventually move there. I think it's a good question to ask, like, how it's going to look like. Mm-hmm. I still think, like, building a framework is very hard in the AI as things are moving very, very fast.
Curious about frameworks. Do you see any rise in popular frameworks that we should be keeping tabs on?
Well, I don't know if this is an unpopular opinion, but, like, people keep telling me LangChain isn't popular, but if you look at its stats, like, it has 20 million downloads per month. Yeah. How can you have not popular framework when it has like 20 million downloads, and it's growing, I think. I think there's a slight bubble in, I don't know if it's like people in SF, but like developers thinking LangChain isn't popular or used. There's one framework that's interesting. I think it's called Mastra.
Yeah,
From one of the founders of
Sam Bhagwat. Yeah, he's in the Discord.
Yeah.
So that I like, that looks very promising. I also like it's like TypeScript first, which I thought like is the right decision, because as we talked about, like, being more bullish on the product developers instead of like a Python machine learning type of a developer. I've seen a lot of more like a toolkits, or I don't know how to call them. Like, for example, Composio has been one that, like, gives you all the tools at once. There have been more tools like that, which is interesting approach. I think also browser-based Stagehand is super exciting, because in my head, it's not a framework. It's like, it doesn't necessarily like dictate how the agent should behave. It just gives it the good tools to navigate a website. And it's very elegant. Like, it has like, I think they added like three methods, right? Act, see, and something.
Yeah, there's three APIs.
Yeah, three APIs.
Observe.
Observe.
Yeah. We talked about it in that episode. No, it's cool. Actually, I wasn't expecting that many names to come out, but these are good names for people to know. I would agree with most of them as they're in the conversation of tooling. And a lot of people listen to us for like, oh, what's going on in SF, right? Like, yeah.
Actually, it's a good question, because like when you ask it, I would expect to be like a bigger framework boom nowadays, because like it would make more sense to build a framework now instead of 23, because things are a little bit more stable. Problem with frameworks is that the idea of frameworks should probably be that things aren't changing underneath your hands, which, like, if you launch your framework in 23, it was. So that's not a fun thing to be at as a developer who's using the framework.
I think things are still changing.
I mean, things are 100% still changing, but slightly, I would say, like, some things are clearer than in 23.
Like, I don't think people realize, but, like, I'll just say it out here, like, check completions is dying. So, like, any framework that was built in that era with, like, no conception of real-time, no conception of omnimodal or multimodal native things, they will probably not age very well.
Yeah. Yeah, probably as we, like, what's the next after chat-based interaction with LLM?
Right. You need check completions, and then you also need reasoning with streaming. And the streaming interactions of agents is also not mapped out very well. Yeah. But like all agent frameworks will have to adjust to that, basically.
Good question to ask when thinking all about DevTools with LLMs. Is my DevTool more relevant as the LLMs are getting smarter and as people need less prompting? I'm for example, like really bad at prompting, but like I can get more work done over the years because the LLMs are getting better. So that means like there's a less need for prompt management type of a thing. Probably.
Yeah. A talk from Ramp at our New York conference was basically about this. Like, how do you set up your architecture so that you benefit from 10,000x improvements in models rather than every time you model improves, you have to kind of throw out your existing workflows?
Yeah, the question we ask very often when thinking about the features and like how to position ourselves in the ecosystem, essentially.
We've gone 51 minutes without talking about MCPs. Which is tragic.
How do you do that? How do you talk about AI infrastructure and no MCP?
Right? It's kind of crazy. But since you mentioned the problems, we just had the episode with the MCP creators, and they were, I wouldn't say not frustrated, but maybe they hope more people will use the prompts and resources in MCP servers instead of just the tool costs. I'm curious if you've seen any fun use cases with like remote MCPs on E2B or any other things like that.
Yeah, MCPs, watching it very closely, but like still undecided what actually like, not what it is, but kind of like what to do with it.
There's no MCP on your docs, bro.
If you go to a GitHub, we have like MCP server.
Okay.
But yeah, we've seen people using E2B to host MCPs. Like, but then I would say like, I don't think you need E2B for that. You can just like, probably you can run it. Like, it's not like even like optimized for it, probably. It's not the, like the, there are probably better ways to do that. I think people are a little bit too much focused on the protocol side of it. Even like calling it a protocol, I don't know. It's just like a server. And there's like a...
Yeah, server and client.
Yeah, server and client. And there's some agreed... So I guess like in a sense, it is a protocol, but like I see a lot of people like comparing to email protocols and such, which seems a little bit far stretched to me at this current moment. But maybe I'm missing something. Like I think it's a super interesting idea. I just haven't had the right insight about it yet.
Hmm.
One last thing I wanted to add, like because we have a bunch of users that added E2B, our MCP server, to their like registries. And so I think, at least at the moment, like it's, what's more useful is like higher order MCPs. I was talking with Henry from Smithery around it, about it, that you know. And he was saying exactly this, telling me exactly this concept. Like, it's unclear who's using the MCP at the moment. Is it a developer? Is it a like end user? Or is it another agent? If it's a developer, then it might be like make sense to have like a sandbox, creation of sandbox in the MCP. But if it's an end user, probably like it's too low level primitive. So you want some kind of higher order MCP. Like instead of us offering like a sandbox, we would be offering like a way to build a CodeGen agent with MCP or something like that.
Mm.
Or run a CodeGen agent that's using E2B MCP like in the background. So I have more like these type of unanswered questions in my head about the MCPs.
I mean, they are all running locally right now, mostly. I don't think there's many remote MCP servers yet. I know that people are pushing for it.
And it looks like there's more remotely, actually. I don't know. This is what I heard from people like managing these registries of MCPs.
Well, they're incentivized to tell you that.
Yeah.
I fully agree with that confusion about what to do. I do think that every dev tools company needs some kind of MCP strategy, for better or worse, it's annoying as it is. I think it does start with having an API though, rather than like a SDK first experience, because then people can just wrap in whatever language that they want. And then you also, for you particularly, you might want to have a distinction in your strategy versus for MCP clients versus MCP servers, because those might be different things. And particularly, I like what you said about the higher order MCP for the end user who doesn't really care about implementation detail. I think that is fantastic for E2B, where like the agents can just spin up an E2B instance in the background and they don't even know about it.
Yeah. In ideal world, we have like mcp.e2b.dev. First, it needs to have figure out authentication.
Yep.
So the agent should just ask to have, I guess, account created for it, whatever it is,
it's
going to be. And then it can just like launch a sandbox, do the execution there, and it can come back to it month later and the state is still there. So that, I think, makes a ton of sense. Then you can start building higher order things on top of that, which could be very interesting. I like what you said about having API first versus SDK first approach. I think this is very, very important for the LLMs. And that's how we are building our whole new dashboard, the infrastructure. So everything needs to be API controllable from like public APIs for users, because eventually the LLMs will want to control and get this data.
Okay, so that's a big shift for E2B, because you're SDK first.
It has been like underneath API based,
of course,
all the time. But now we will go more into it. And it was more like a, in terms of prioritization. So we needed to start with humans to get to LLMs and first build for human developer and then now building for like a LLM developer first.
Yeah. I'll just call out that since we did the MCP episode, they announced their update to the spec that they added an auth component to the spec itself. It seems to be just based on OAuth 2.1. And I assume, like, you know, that's the first easiest thing to do, but there's no effective distinction between an agent and an user. Yeah. So we never had that.
I think this touches more like a broader question of, you have like all the websites that has optimized everything for humans, but now you will have like agents visiting those websites. Like, what are the incentives there? You know, like, probably you as a website owner, you want to know it's an agent because you spend so much time and money optimizing everything for humans. So I think like the dynamics on the internet might get really weird if you don't have a distinction. This is a human, this is agent.
Yeah, we tried to record an episode with Matthew Prince, CEO of Cloudflare, yesterday, and then we had technical difficulties, but they're building a lot of
that.
You
can see the stats. The stats are
Yeah. They mentioned, for example, used to be, you know, Google would be a 2-to-1 crawl to referral ratio. So for every two pages they will read, they will send you one visitor.
Yeah.
He said OpenAI is 250-to-1. So they'll read 250 of your pages and send you one person. And Anthropic was like 6,000-to-1.
Wow.
So they'll read 6,000 pages before they send one person back to your website. So obviously we have Jeremy Howard, who's been working on LLMs.txt to kind of have a separate interface for that. I think today people don't really curate the LLM experience. I think a lot of the LLM.txt that people are making is like automated. Take a website and turn it into LLM.txt. But like, that's not really what you want to do. It's like, how do you separate completely the two things? You know, like if you're e-commerce store, the LLM.txt should have your own inventory and like one thing, you know, shouldn't have a search button.
I feel like obviously LLM.txt is a good movement that improve the legibility of these doc sites for LLMs. But I feel like it's kind of like a halfway measure. Like, I think we've failed with agents if we are reshaping the human environment for agents. Mm-hmm. Like, there must be two of everything. What's your human side and what's your agent side? Like, no, like agents should just be the human side. Like, why are we making any special dispensation for these things?
Yeah, I think the monetization is the only thing. Like, too many websites are like ads driven, kind of like
You need to look at it, right?
Yeah, I think you need to change. Once we figure that out, you know, I think you can use the same interface. But I think today, just like all these pop ups, it's like, okay, fuck,
so
man, stop popping.
Bitcoin solves this.
Yeah.
I'm just kidding. But anyway, I don't know if you have a take on all this.
I have like a general rule that usually when something new comes out, people have this tendency to recreate the thing that already exists for the new thing. Like, that's like the internet for agents, versus you already have all the infrastructure for the old thing and probably might be easier to teach the new thing to use the old thing. I think it's very common coming from developers that it will be a perfect world when you have nice clear distinction between these two, but actually the world is super messy. So nothing comes to my mind that they would like end up that you have clear distinction between like two type of sort of entities, or we created like a new internet for just mobile phones. You actually have both website, like desktop website version and mobile phone version, right? It's much more always like complicated and messy in the real world than having like nice clear distinction, which is something I think developers strive for, like just from working with code, because you want this nice clear distinction. But humans are more complicated than that. So I think like everything ends up being sort of mixed, and you need to adapt to it.
For sure. Yeah, I think we'll do this for 20 years and then we'll figure out the
magic. Yeah. And probably it will be somewhere in between that you have like a world where agents are using human internet, but the internet changed because you have agents or something like that.
This reminds me of some conversation that I think, I don't know who was making this analogy. Like, in the mobile era, we had m.yourdomain.com, and then we had www.yourdomain.com, and now we might have like just lm.yourdomain.com, and that's just the LLM experience.
MCP though.
Oh yeah, of course. way better. Yeah, consumes everything. Cool. We're just gonna go through all the rest of the use cases. We can refer people to your website, but I always want people to have a good mental map of when they should go to E2B and like, or what other people are using E2B so that they don't miss out, right? So it's AI data analysis, data visualization, coding agents, generative UI, code gen evals, and computer use. Do you think that's like the sequence of most popular is data analysis, least popular is computer use?
Right? Most experimental is computer use, I would say.
Yeah.
It still gets a lot of traction when you share, you know, the demos of it.
It's just Manus. Who else is doing this? I basically don't see anyone else.
When you say compute reuse, like I imagine like a graphical interface.
Uh-huh.
Manus, as far as I know,
Manus doesn't. Yeah,
yeah, it doesn't isn't running that. So would also call it kind of compute reuse, but without graphical interface, because you are using the full computer, but more from like code point of view. But that's a different discussion. I would say like computer use is very exciting, but experimental from what I've seen.
Yeah. Okay.
I think for real computer use, you really want to support more platforms than just Linux.
Yeah. Windows. Yeah. Right.
And then Mac. It might be more licensing battle than technical battle.
Yeah. Lawyers always win.
Yeah.
We'll probably have Eric from Pig at some point talk about his movements on Windows. So they're also going to go into evals, right? And also how that links to RFT. Yeah, just like, can you tell more stories about the Open R1 project, how you work with them, and any other like academics that are working with E2B that you think could be possible for like the research or model training use case or fine tuning use case?
Yeah, the way Hugging Face, who built the Open R1 project, is using us is during like the code gen reinforcement learning step, where the R1 model, the open R1 model has a training step where they give it a code problem and the model needs to generate and run code somewhere. Then you have reward function basically giving you 0 or 1, telling you if that was a good solution or bad solution, then you improve the model. So kind of like the feedback loop. They are using the E2B sandboxes to, you know, run many hundreds of these sandboxes, thousands of these sandboxes per training step. So they can achieve like big parallelization. We started very fast. You don't need to use your GPU cluster for that, which is like very expensive to use for these type of workloads. And also, and that goes with the story that I mentioned in the beginning, is that you don't need to worry about like the LLM actually like changing permissions in your cluster, and then you can't access the cluster because everything is isolated and is secure from each other. So I think that's a very, very interesting use case, because we've had a few other companies like reaching out and started using us this way, building models, foundation models. It's like when we started E2B, that wasn't the use case that we had in mind. So, but it's like makes total sense if you think about like life cycle of an AI agent, like it makes a lot of sense for us to be like from the earliest stage possible. And the earliest stage is probably model training. So this fits very, very, very nicely in that use case. We actually released a case study with Hugging Face that's on our website that people can read.
Have you seen people also use that to evaluate agents they want to use, or is it mostly people doing training?
We've seen people using E2B for evals.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking. Like, it should be very easy to run like Suebench and all these on E2B.
Yeah, this is more foreshadowing, but we will be launching in the next couple of months like a startup and research program for people and universities and researchers like doing exactly these type of things. A different use case, but we, for example, work with LM Arena folks from Berkeley that are using us to compare models in AI app generation, and we run the AI generated app.
He wrote that integration, right?
Yes. I think like that's only possible thanks to Alessio, and I'm not joking, like, because like first he connected it and then he actually wrote it.
Man, the things you have to do to win deals these days.
Full stack value add.
Well, like, I think he was already our investor, so okay, I think that also shows it even a better light, because you clearly see the person is not interested just to win the deal, but actually, you know,
to increase the value of the investment.
Exactly. Talk about value add. Like how many VCs are actually fixing your bug in your in your code base.
Let's make a YouTube short of this part so I can share it.
You should put it on our landing page.
Yeah, exactly. So let's talk about, since you mentioned VCs, a lot of VCs that passed on you before because you only do code execution. It's kind of like a small market. I would love for you to maybe also paint the picture, you know? So you just mentioned it's cheaper than the GPU cluster than Hugging Face has. Do you want to do GPUs in the future? You mentioned Railway. That was easy to do. Do you want to compete with Railway down the line? Like, where do you see E2B going?
So GPU question is an interesting one. GPU market is hard. Like, you are competing on the compute internal, I think it's hard, because eventually you will have competitors and everyone will be like pricing it a little lower and no one is making any margin. So that's like, but it just opens new use cases for you. And for example, even with the data analysis, if you just run, I think it's Pandas code from, there's a recent update. If you just run it on GPU, it's like twice as much faster. If we want to like do really big AI data analysis, you need that. So I think like GPUs for us, and also if you want to like have LLM train small machine learning models, maybe you want to like build full games, you really want to offer the full cloud computer, but in cloud. That's very elastic. So I think GPUs are there on the roadmap. I wouldn't say it's like the thing that we are immediately working on, but eventually it makes like a lot of sense for us to offer this. And sorry, what was the other question?
On the, do you want to host the apps that so you are building to?
That's,
you
know, we are very well positioned that the LLM is doing all the development work with us. Then you need to deploy it somewhere. So it's like very natural next step. Eventually, like we want the LLMs to deploy these services, apps that they are building, and have them manage it. And developer is more like in the backseat, like looking at things if everything is working correctly. If your swarm of agents is working correctly, it also requires a slightly different infrastructure for deploying. But I think there's a big advantage in knowing what developers are building on your platform. And then, because then you can see like what's the ideal, even from technical point of view, you have all the insights that you need to actually effectively deploy it and kind of then cover the full life cycle of building the app. But now it's not built by the human developer, it's built by the AI. So I like TLDR, yes, probably down the road somewhere, like we want to build essentially like the new AWS, but for LLMs.
So we're just going to move out and, you know, just to wrap up, one of the interesting things that I saw you do was you were originally Czech-based. And I'll be very blunt. When I first invested in the early round that you did, I was like, these guys know how to recruit in Czech Republic. It's like a competitive advantage. And then the next thing I know, you're moving to SF, your whole team.
You show up to our office. That's hilarious.
I actually, I think you, you offered even your place like to live for a few days. Yeah.
So why move to SF? Do you think that everybody in your similar situation should? Any pros and cons that you're experiencing?
I think it's you can definitely build a DevTool company from Europe. I think it's a lot about question of how easy you want it to be in the earlier days, especially if you are building like a kind of like red ocean versus blue ocean waters. If you are building in a field that already exists and you have like large competitors, you are building something that's 10 times, 100 times better, you probably don't need to be NSF. You probably will need some kind of US base because for your sales and customers, but you can very well build this from Europe. I know great companies doing that because the knowledge is already among all the developers. But I would maybe argue that it might be harder to find people that are comfortable with a fast iteration loop and changing things early on. You know, like almost we are pivoting every week, every month. But the main motivation for us was we just wanted to be very close to our users. And it was clear after a few weeks that SF is becoming this AI hub. And what we used to do, and we still do it sometimes, but slightly less because of like not having that much time and resources. But we just met with the customers that had problems, our users, and we just like implemented E2B for them, like next to them, like we made a PR.
I call this the collision installation.
Yeah. By the way, I don't know if this is like a known thing, but do you know how many times they did that?
200? I don't know.
Twice? Three times?
Oh, lol.
I asked about it like 3 years ago when I had a chance to ask a question from Patrick Collison, like how many times you did the Collison installation? And he was like, three times. But then after that, you probably don't want to do that because you want to automate things and focus on other stuff. Nice. But it's exactly like do the things that don't scale.
Three times.
exactly three.
But my whole point was that how many such users I can meet in Prague in a week versus in San Francisco in a week. In Prague, it's going to be probably one, and then I can't meet anyone else for the next half of the year because I just don't have users in Prague. But all of my users, our users, were here. So we could just keep repeating doing that again and again. I would even argue we did it too much. We could have automated slightly faster. But it's very useful feedback that you can get. And you can then start moving much, much, much faster. Yeah. So that was important. And I think like also eventually you are in like you are in the B2B business even from the early days, and it's good to have good relationship with people, and just like meeting it in person is just better than meeting it over Zoom.
Well, I mean, that's why we do this in person. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, obviously I run a conference. I'm very sympathetic to people meeting in person, right? But I also want there to be some hope for people who are never going to come to SF, that like they can still get involved. That's partially why we do this podcast, is to get them involved in the community.
And I mean, we started a new office in Prague. So
yes, you're hiring again in Prague.
Yeah.
Yes.
And I think that there's really good talent in Europe, in Czech Republic, for example. I can't speak for other countries, but I can imagine it's very similar. Once you have like a clear idea of what your product looks like, then you can find really good expert on certain part of your infrastructure, on database and things like that, and just like have top talent for that. The reason we didn't want to do it early on was because we kind of didn't know ourselves what we were building, and we had to figure it out in person with users here. But now we feel much more strong about like knowing the roadmap for the company and for the product. And so it's much easier to, you know, hire people that have 8-hour difference from us and explain them like what they are building, even remotely sometimes, that if you are not there and you're just communicating through Slack.
Just to wrap, what are the roles that you're hiring for?
So we are hiring distributed systems engineers. We are hiring platform engineers, AI engineers. I'm also hiring account manager and customer success engineer. So kind of all over the place. We see a lot of market pull and momentum being built up. So we want to double down and move even faster because we see all the potential what we can do. And just want to kind of like, you want to pour the gas on the fire, on the spark. And that's how I feel where we are now at E2B.
Awesome, man. Very cool. Thank you so much for coming on.
Yeah, thank you for having me. It's great.